Okay, so my name is Monica Eileen Patterson, and I am here today with Dr. David Pilgrim, who is the founder of the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia in Big Rapids, Michigan. Thank you so much for agreeing to share your time with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I thought that I would start by asking you to just tell our listeners a little about the museum.
Okay. Well, if you had asked me that question 3 months ago, I would have answered by saying we are a 5,000-piece collection of mostly segregation and anti-black caricatured material. But today, what I'll say is that we are a 9,000-piece collection because we just had a major gift given by a family of a lifelong collector in Columbus, Ohio, gave us about 3,000 or 4,000 pieces. Our goal is to use those objects to get people to talk openly and honestly about race, race relations, and racism. And so we bring people to that little room, and we have structured exercises. And at the risk of sounding immodest, I believe it is one of the places in this country where people are talking openly and honestly about those topics.
When did you first start collecting racist memorabilia?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I get the folklore, I mean, I get the myth confused in my own head at this point, but I do know that when I was very young, I purchased a piece and destroyed it. And I've tried to recreate that in my head to try to remember what was going on and how old I was and the like. And the best I can figure is I was probably, you know, 11, 12, or 13. The interesting thing is I don't remember the second piece or the third piece or the fourth piece, but I always remember collecting it. And in those days, and we're talking about 100 years ago, it was everywhere. I mean, I grew up my ancestry is Native and African, but I grew up black identified. And so the black neighborhood that I grew up in, you would find those pieces in their homes, which seems a little surprising, I guess. But the material just everywhere. By the time I got to college, I had begun to collect in earnest. And the only thing that really limited me was that I never had a lot of money. But every place I went, every college I attended, when I went to graduate school at The Ohio State University, I started collecting more pieces there. I'll give you a seminal moment. Was I had finished graduate school, moved to Indiana, and had my first teaching position, and someone advertised that they were selling their collection. And in retrospect, it wasn't that large a collection, but at the time, it seemed like it was huge. I don't know, probably 60 pieces or whatever. And it was at the time that I purchased that collection from them that I felt that I had a real collection. And I can tell you other stories, but I don't want to bore you.
No, it's not boring at all. Could you give us a sense of some of the items that are in these personal collections and some of the items that you encountered in going into people's homes?
I had a friend once who, I made a challenge to him. I said to him, if you name 10 everyday objects, I will find, if I don't already have, I will find a racist version of that object. And if you go in our collection, what you'll find is that the 10 things that he mentioned, we are overly represented in those areas, because I get in the habit of really looking for those pieces. For example, ashtrays. You know, he mentioned also, which now seems like it would have been too easy, but postcards. I bet you we have it at, you know, somewhere between 600 and 700 racist postcards. For us, that's important because racism so permeated our culture that it had to be reflected in the objects that we produced as a culture. And so if you went in someone's home, whether it was the kitchen with detergent or, you know, flour or cereal or whatever, or you went into the living room and watched television shows where you'd find racist cartoons, and or I guess what you would call whatnots or knickknacks or these little souvenir type pieces, you know, whatever you could imagine a person using, a license plate, the switch plate that you use to, you know, for your light bulbs, glasses, drinking glasses, I mean, toys, games, sheet music, clothing objects. And again, I would challenge that if someone were to name 10 everyday objects, that I would probably have a racist version of that. And that has less to do with me being an obsessive collector with the fact that, again, those objects that just dominated in our culture. By the way, let me tell you one other story, and real quick. I never knew what I was going to do with this stuff. I mean, I knew that I wanted to collect it, and I was collecting a lot of it. I had some vague ideas about using it as visual aids when I would travel, give talks at different schools. And I went to a woman's home, and it took me about 6 months to convince her. She was an elderly woman in her 90s. And I joked that I basically dated her, courted her for all the time, because she did not trust me at all. She believed that if she ever showed me her collection, I was going to want it. And I kept saying, no, I'm not going to want it. I just want to see it, because I'd heard so much about her collection. And she eventually showed me her collection, and it was the most amazing thing. If you were in a room where the ceilings were 10 or 12 feet high, and just imagine shelving that almost reached literally reached the top, and just row after row after row of every conceivable object you could think of. That's what I saw. And I think it was at that moment that I decided that I wanted to create that experience that I was having right then for other people. And I worried in some way that unless someone, it didn't have to be me, but unless someone did it at a university or in a museum, that it would be lost in some way. And I think, now she's passed away now, but you know, people are in our lives for reasons, I believe. That doesn't sound very sociological. I mean, most sociologists aren't metaphysical. But I do believe that the reason that made sense for that interaction was that it gave a kind of concreteness to what I should be doing.
So one of the main goals of your collection has turned out to be leveraging these items for educational purposes. Mm-hmm. Why was she collecting?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. She, well, first of all, she was smart in terms of business. And these, in the late 60s and early 70s, when the civil rights movement had sort of helped change the way people saw the past, and there was a lot of shame. You know, keep in mind, folk had watched the ABC footage of the protesters being beaten and all of that, and there'd been probably about a 10-year period of sort of reflection in our culture. And so what happened was a lot of people started throwing away these objects, and they literally were throwing away objects that one day could have made them rich. And she just went around collecting them. And I don't, you know, I talked to her about that, and I'd like to say that she had a kind of philosophical or ideological, you know, bent where she wanted to use them for education, but, and I mean her no disrespect when I say this, I just think she recognized that there was going to be an incredible market for this stuff one day. And we used to talk about that, and the fact is that she was right, because in the mid-1980s, you know, some of these pieces that, you know, you could have purchased for a quarter, you know, a decade before, we're going for hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And so I think, again, I mean her no disrespect, but I should say she was an antique dealer. And so that was her focus was on business. But she didn't sell the stuff. I mean, she sold the cheap imitations, but the original vintage stuff is what she had in the back. And the unfortunate epilogue, of course, of the story is that when she passed away, her heirs just quickly got the stuff back out on the market. But we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. Actually, the collection that I donated to Ferris, you know, had I been inclined, I could have gotten a couple $100,000 for that collection.
It seems that most people would assume racist memorabilia means antiques. Mm-hmm. Is that the case, or are these objects still in production?
Yeah, it also means antiques, or you know, vintage or what I call authentic pieces. But there's not an object in our museum that you could not purchase today. But there's also not an object where the imagery is not being reproduced today. So all the old paper pieces that used to be the wrappings on, soup cans or the imagery that was on trade cards or postcards, those things are reproduced on the faces of clocks or what do you call the lunch pails or lunch boxes and metal tins. So there is probably, I say this and I think I can say it without fear of being wrong, that there is not an image in our museum that's not currently being made, from the past, that's not currently being made. But it is also the case that there are new caricatures that are being created. A lot of, I found this, I went to Myrtle Beach. And if you think of one of the caricatures of Africans and their American descendants was this sort of coon caricature, the ne'er-do-well, hedonistic, just wants to get drunk, have fun, have sex, that whole thing. And in terms of the physical caricature, part of it was, oversized genitalia, all the stereotypical kind of things. Well, when I went to Myrtle Beach, what I discovered is that that same caricature exists, except it's morphed into a depiction of West Indian Africans. And so it's still the same, it's the same setup, except now the black person has dreadlocks and instead of a whiskey bottle has a marijuana cigarette in his mouth and all the other stuff, the physical caricatures and all is still there. And that happens quite a bit, where an old caricature morphs into the present. And then, of course, there's just, quite frankly, just brand new caricatures that never existed in the past. So a lot of what we have in the museum, despite the name, it are actually newer pieces. And that was an accident. I chose the name Jim Crow because it encompassed the period of the objects that I had at the time. But I made a very fortuitous decision to continue collecting newer pieces. And in terms of having good discussions, our best discussions are actually, they actually revolve around the newer pieces. And so when young people come in and they see like the objects I'm talking about from Myrtle Beach, and they're not just Myrtle Beach, by the way, but when they see those, then we can have the kinds of conversations I want to have about racial stereotyping and prejudice and discrimination.
So who comes to the Jim Crow Museum?
Well, it is primarily a facility for Ferris students and faculty. So each year we have, I think we have 4 or 5 dozen classes that come. But increasingly, because of the web presence, we have people coming working on their theses and dissertations and just doing research. We have lots of civil rights and human rights groups who come. We also have the, I don't know how you would say this, sort of the lay historian types. I mean, to me, they're scholars, even though they're not officially recognized sometimes. But we have a lot of those people who have like an interest in history, but not necessarily a formal training. We have a number of people who come as part of documentaries. I have to tell you, though, that I'm a little leery often of those people because I don't want someone just to come there to exploit the collection, you know. And I want to make sure that what it is they're doing is consistent with our mission, which is to use objects of intolerance to teach tolerance. But each year we do support probably 4 documentaries. I don't know if you know Carvin Eisen, but he did the documentary 1964, and he recently did a documentary about lynching imagery in the past and also during the most recent presidential campaign involving President Obama. And so we worked with him, you know, to supply him some of the imagery he wanted, but also to contextualize a lot of it. And we've done documentaries with people from Wales and the BBC and all over. But again, you know, we really put them through the ringer to make sure that what it is they're doing is consistent with what we're doing. So I guess what I'm saying is we have lots of different types of people who come, but until we move, unfortunately we're getting ready to move, we never had like scheduled tours. As soon as we move, which hopefully will be by this time next year, there will be visitors in the new facility. What my plan is to have 2 scheduled tours a day. And the significance of that is that means we will probably open ourselves up more to just, quote, the curious. Because, you know, to get in there right now, you have to watch a documentary. You have to be a part of a group, you know, either a class or a civil rights organization, whatever, or doing what I believe to be legitimate research.
So when it's open a year from now, it'll be open to the general public? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's open to the general public now in a way. You know, it's just that we structure it so much. There'll be less of that kind of structure because in the new facility, you know, we will have the prerequisite, you know, didactic panels and kiosks and all the stuff that it'll be much more docent friendly, but it'll also be more visitor friendly. And so I will have less of a concern about someone leaving there and not getting it. But what we have been mainly is a kind of laboratory.
And that was that relates to a question I wanted to ask. How do you reach people who might think this is not my history, mm-hmm. or I'm not racist, or mm-hmm. worse yet, racism is not a problem?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, with us, you know, I make a couple points when people come in. The first thing I say is I'm not directly proselytizing to any of you. You can leave here with the same racial ideas or ideas about race that you had when you came in. That's up to you. But what we will do while you're in here is to talk and listen deeply about race. And whether or not it changes values, that's on people. But what we can do is we can create a safe space, an intelligent space, where we can have that dialogue. And that's the only part we take ownership with. Now, it is, of course, the case that because the objects are what they are, that people often do have a kind of emotional response, and that's to be expected. As a matter of fact, I would say the most common emotional response I get from anyone is a kind of reflective sadness. And if it stayed there, then I failed, you know. What I have seen, though, is that reflective sadness is actually sort of a crack in the door to a person's willingness to talk about and learn about race. See, it's like, I'll tell you one thing I learned with this material. the more, quote, racist something is, the less useful it is for dialogue. So if it has the word nigga in it, and I only use that word as in relationship to the museum stuff. I don't use it in jest or as a slur, but it is what it is, and it's on hundreds of pieces that we have. But if that word is on an object, then there's no real dialogue we have, unless the dialogue is about the word. If a piece is heavily caricatured, there's not a lot of dialogue, because we all agree, even the most racist among us would agree that that's offensive. But it's the pieces like Aunt Jemima and Little Black Sambo and Little Brown Coco, what you might call borderline pieces, that have the best record or track record for stimulating conversation. Because that's where you hear things like someone will say when they look at Aunt Jemima that that for them represents wholesomeness. It represents a time well spent as a child with a parent and very good memories. And for them, that's real. Someone else will say that when they see that, what they see is a slur and the vestiges of segregation, if not slavery. The thing I'm trying to do is to get those two sets of ideas in the same room and people listening. And again, that's the purpose of the room. It's not a shrine to racism. What it is again, like in a laboratory, using those pieces to find out where we are and then to listen to where other people are as we try to better understand racial identity. And I don't want to engage in hyperbole, but if there is a racial gulf, there's certainly a racial gap still. But whatever that is, to try to get people to understand that better.
Seems that it must be very challenging to create a situation in which people are coming with such different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with the uneven nature? How do you deal with the uneven nature of the painfulness of mm-hmm. the materials?
Well, again, there is the pain piece, and I used to try to hide behind just being very sterile and academic. And although that, in a kind of cathartic way, was safe for me, it really didn't deal with the fact that the pieces actually were painful for people, or some people. And this is now where I am with that. And this is going to sound, I don't want it to sound coarse, but this is just where my head is right now on that. And that is that we need to mature and grow up as a culture. And as individuals, and to be willing to have difficult conversations. It's like in the U.S., there is like this fondness, this obsessive fondness for happy history. You know, we celebrate all these, you know, things. And then there is this fear and loathing and running away from the parts of our history that deal with the type of stuff I have. And that's not just on a cultural level, that's on an individual level. And so part of it is to get people to recognize that those conversations, though difficult, are necessary. And if I had my druthers, they would have been having those conversations long, 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 long before they came into the museum. But many people haven't had those. Now, I try to be compassionate. You know, my experience is that most, in terms of racial reconciliation, racial understanding, racial whatever, one-time episodic conversations don't really help that much anyway. What we need are sustained dialogues. And the best that museum at its best, is when I have, like, groups that are there 10 times, and where we have... Well, we know that you don't have to do the narrative making and posturing or whatever, but you're going to get another chance to talk. And I believe that's how we need to be dealing with race anyway, is sustained dialogue in small groups. Now, still, some things are just painful. I mean, I have a piece that I'll never show. This has been an argument. John Thorpe helped me found the museum. And we agreed, he's retired now and gone into the great world of retirement. He's still in the area. But we had a major disagreement about whether or not to show a piece. And what it is, someone went to a lynching. And, lynchings in the real world weren't just someone being hanged. They were people being burned and tied behind wagons and castrated and everything else. And someone there cut off a little piece of this guy's arm. And and they tanned it, you know. And it's probably the size of, you know, it's probably, I don't know, you know, 8 inches long and 3 inches wide. And if you didn't really know, I mean, unless you look at it closely, you think, what the heck, you know. But otherwise, you wouldn't even know what you're looking at, probably. And I need to tell the story about lynchings in the U.S., although it's been told lately very well. The Without Sanctuary Traveling Exhibit does that. But there's no way we can tell the story of Jim Crow without talking about the violence that undergirded the whole system. I mean, the system wouldn't work without both the threat of violence and actual violence. And there would be no piece in there, other than probably some of our lynching postcards, there would be no piece that would demonstrate that as much, you know. But I just have, maybe that's the native part of me, because I never liked, you know, museums having, people in them, you know, exhibiting the remains of people that have passed. I never liked that. And I don't like illustrating or showing parts of people, you know. Now, on the other hand, John's point is that that piece would speak more than I could in 50 books, just that one little piece. And I agree. So I know that would be, to get to your question about pain, that would be a painful thing for people. But I haven't reconciled to myself that that's the best way to, because again, my thing is about education. I mean, when it's all said and done, the museum was founded at a university for a reason. That's because we're educators. And the dialogue we believe in, because we believe in the triumph of dialogue. If not, we couldn't be educators. We should quit education. But then some dialogues are harder than others.
I'm wondering if you have anything to say specifically to our Canadian listeners, many of whom might not be aware that there was also Jim Crow in Canada.
Absolutely. We have some pieces from many countries, and we have some pieces from Canada, but they look just like the pieces that we have from the U.S., you know. And patterns of Jim Crow did exist here, as they did in other places. The lessons are what's important. Whether a piece was found in Montreal or Flint, Michigan, I mean, it's the message behind whatever it is. And more than that, it's the potential of using it to teach. So I believe that just like Americans can learn from viewing that material and having those discussions, absolutely, people in Canada, Mexico, and other places can do so also. I'm not yet in possession of a piece of racist or even sexist or homophobic memorabilia, because I collect those now, from Montreal, but that's because I haven't looked today. And the reason I said it is because I had never been to a city in the world, certainly no city in the United States, where I did not find at least one piece. Now, it's made easier today because about 7 years ago, I started collecting objects that defame other groups. And so I will leave and walk around and try to find something. And, you know, there's obviously a part of me that longs for the day when I walk in a city, even a big city, like Montreal, and there's just nothing. You know, nothing that defames Africans or their North American descendants, nothing that defames women, nothing that defames gays or Pakistanis or Inuits or Mexicans or any group. But one quick story. I was down in El Paso, right on the border by Juarez. I mean, literally on the border. And that's a tough situation down there these days, by the way. But I was the guy that was touring me around. I told him that I'd never been in a city in the U.S. without finding something. He's like, oh, we don't have that here. It's like, oh, that's great. But can you take me around to a few stores? He's like, sure. And I realized it was near Halloween, and I realized I hadn't gone into a Halloween store yet, because Halloween stores are notorious for taking ethnic groups and exaggerating their features until they become monstrous and using them as Halloween wear. And I hadn't been yet. And he was like, yeah, but there's not going to be anything in there. We don't have that. I said, okay, fine. So I go in, we go into this Halloween USA, and there's an outfit, a costume of a drunken Mexican. And it's up high, so I can't reach it. And I call the person over to help me get it, who was a Mexican-American. So he gets it down for me, and then I purchase it from the clerk, who was Mexican national. And the person who owned the store was European-American. I find all this stuff out before I leave any time. And so then I thought to myself, isn't this interesting? Here you have, in myself, a person who's native and black identified, purchasing an anti-Mexican costume from a Mexican and a Mexican national in a store owned by a European-American, a costume that was made in Taiwan. And that not only happened for that period, but that happened throughout our history, where you get all these sort of weird intersections and people don't get it. And that night when I gave my talk in El Paso, I showed the object. And people giggle about the drunken Mexican costume. And then we talked about it. And I finished my presentation, and then we did exactly what we would have done in the museum after that. And that was, I asked people, when you look at this, what is it you see? And then when they tell me what they see, and then I ask them, why is it you say that? And then I ask them, why else do you say that? And before you know it, we are having a fairly deep conversation about all the stuff we bring to what it is we see. I think we all still have a lot of, I'm ranting now, I apologize. Mm-hmm. But I think we still have a lot of baggage about race. And it's like when I was a kid in Alabama, it was like a suitcase. Now it's mostly like a carry-on. But it's either overhead or under our feet and close enough to, you know, to get to. And I would imagine that that's the case, whether I'm in the U.S. or Canada, Mexico, or Peru, or wherever.
Do you still encounter people who, in viewing the drunken Mexican costume, might leave that room saying, that's just harmless fun?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. And the purpose of dialogue means I get to talk too. And usually, like in the museum, in part because I've already spoken through the documentary, I don't talk a whole lot, because it's just I'm trying to get the people to talk amongst themselves or between amongst. When I do talk, one of the things I say is that, you know, something can be offensive and racist or sexist. Those are not mutually exclusive categories. And as simple a point as that is, I think it's lost on a lot of people until it's pointed out. And especially a lot of our younger visitors, you know, say, oh, you know, you just don't have a sense of humor. That's not true. I'm the funniest person I know. Sometimes when I'm just by myself, I'm just laughing, and because I have a great sense of humor. But, you know, I hear this thing about I'm a prude or just want to stop people from having fun. That's not the case. But the fact is that humor can be an especially pernicious way to spread ideas of social injustice, just like games and toys can be.
Well, thank you very much.
That's it?
Well, I would love to keep going forever, but I was told to aim for about 30 minutes, and we're at 36. But I also just wanted to give you a chance to, you know, if you think that I missed anything, or if there's anything. One thing that I didn't ask was about the future. Because in the next iteration of the museum, are you broadening that to the larger issues of other related issues of oppression?
Yeah. The new space will be expanded just for the Jim Crow stuff. But the old space that I was in, I'm going to use that room. I don't know if I should be saying this on any kind of tape, even miles away from home. But my plan, as sneaky as it is that as soon as we move in, I mean literally the next day, I'm going to take now the thousands of pieces that we have on women and gays and Irish and Italians and Jews and Arabs and whatever, and put in that room, and then the day after that start complaining that that room is too small. And I'm already planning that. And of course we, you know, I always want to have a presence at fairs, but I'm also looking to expand a bigger, much bigger thing at some point down in the Grand Rapids area, which is obviously a bigger city. But the first thing was to just get this first place built, and it has taken forever to get that. But the good news with that is the DTE Foundation took a chance. Our problem with corporations was simple. No one wanted to be the first because they were afraid they'd be the only one. And they were afraid that when you write it up in your publicity, in your newspaper, if you already got enemies, and most corporations do have some enemies, you kind of position yourself to be slandered in a way that's not accurate, you know, that you're supporting this Jim Crow museum, whatever. And I had a chance to meet with the president of the foundation, and I said to him, just give me an opportunity to meet with the members of your board who think this is a stupid idea. Just put me in the same room with them and just let me have a conversation, and I'll answer their questions because I know what it is I'm trying to do. And they did, and so they're going to give us to start $250,000, and that's a good lead gift. And then we already had some money. But what is also done is now to make it much easier for the second company to say, because DTE is a recognized, I mean, it's not like Bob's Barbecue down the street or something, you know, I mean, it's a major player. So that's good, and I'm really looking forward to that place. My great fear in life was that I'd die before that place was moved. And then I'd like to, the traveling exhibits are doing well, but they're just hard to manage, you know. But I'd like to create another one because I either want to do one that's only on women, or I want to do one that is on, this is going to sound really narrow, President Obama and the imagery that came out about him. And I think there's a market for those in terms of the exhibits, but you know, for me, it's just all the same. It's just all finding two- and three-dimensional objects that I can use to get people to talk better. You know, it's such a pathetic, and it sounds harsh, but it's such a pathetic part of us that wants to avoid dealing with difficult things. things. I mean, the trick is not to stop talking about it, it's to figure out how to talk about it better and to do the work that's necessary. So the future for me is first get the new Jim Crow Museum relocated, and get that open, move the other material in the other place, start clamoring for a bigger space for that. And then I think I'm going to go with the women's traveling exhibit, then build, because we have a lot of pieces about women. And one of my friends, he had a great point when I told him I wanted to start collecting stuff on women. He said, where would you stop? I mean, that's a brilliant point. I mean, there's so much. And it's just everywhere. Just absolutely. Burger King ads, I mean, just everywhere. So, but we've collected a lot of it, you know. And what I'd like to see eventually is as far as get a museum studies program. We had people from Smith College volunteer their students to serve interns once we were relocated. That's a real feather in your cap. That's a great institution. So I'd like to see us start doing, you know, getting internships for people to come and work the collection. Took forever to photograph and catalog the collection. Because when I was young, I didn't even know what catalog meant. I didn't know what, and of course we didn't have, it wasn't as easy anyway in those days. I mean, we didn't have all the digital, you know, the Embark program and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so a lot of it has been catching up, trying to remember who I bought that from and what year that was. And some of these pieces were made so long, I mean, over such a long period of time that you really can't say this is a 1930s piece. I mean, it started in 1920s and it went up to the 1970s. So, but, you know, so a part of it is also getting that piece in you know, the organizationally.
What are the biggest challenges in making connections across different forms of oppression, such as sexism and racism and mm-hmm. homophobia?
Well, one part of it is that, you know, the same sorts of, you know, stereotypical thinking that we find in parts of the dominant group, we find in subordinate groups, and sometimes in a vicious and vile way. I'm just a storyteller. I'm sorry. When I was in graduate school one night, I was in a room, and we probably had like six ethnic / racial minority groups represented in that room, and we got into this really non-productive discussion about who's headed the worst. And what led to that discussion was my professor, or our professor, Dr. Robert Jobo, who was a third-generation Japanese-American sansei, had just gotten a $20,000 check from the federal government to, you know, sort of pay them back for losing their business and home and stuff during the internment. And the six of us were furious that, you know, why in the heck would he get that money, you know, and not somebody else? And we had that discussion. And I've thought about that night a lot because it represents both the worst of what I think should be happening, but also a seed to something good that could be happening. And that is trying to get different groups, if they're not going to be political allies, you know, at least to listen and to try to understand that you may not have been heard in the same way. And this also goes for members of the so-called dominant group. You may not be have been hurt in the same way, but you know what it means to be hurt. You know what it means to be summarily dismissed because of some ascribed characteristic that you have. And you don't need to know some of the specifics to understand. And I think that we need to do more of that. Not just political alliances, but actual dialoguing. I have pretty much put all my chips in on the whole dialoguing thing. And the person who says to me that talk doesn't matter, they should shut up because they shouldn't be talking. I believe that thinking through, working through, and trying to meet in words and understanding. That's what we have. And anything good comes out of that. And again, I don't think I could be an educator if I didn't believe that. You know, we just have class and stare at each other. You know. So I think that's part of the challenge. You know, I get criticized. When I came up with the DEM exhibit, which has images from a lot of groups, I had African Americans saying to me that watered down the other stuff we were doing. I have a couple of, I don't know what you call them, I go right wing. I don't know. At a certain point, right wing becomes left wing. I mean, they're more of a horseshoe than they are a continuum. But just extremist groups, religious groups, African-American religious cult-like groups who write me all the time demanding that I stop my advocacy for rights for gays and lesbians. And they're just furious, and they say that undermines the work that I'm doing with the Jim Crow Museum. Well, fortunately, in my opinion, that's a minority of view among African-Americans, or at least the ones that I'm dealing with. But it does speak to these schisms, you know. In my job as Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion, I just brought in the Black Jew Dialogue. Actually, I'm missing it. It's tonight. Okay. Is it tonight or tomorrow? I'm missing it either way because I'm here. But the purpose of that is, A, to show sort of the gap that has been created in recent years between Blacks and Jews, but beyond that, to just use that as an example of conflict between groups and promise between groups, because those groups worked so well in the civil rights movement and in many cases work well today. And one of the questions I got from people with that was, it's like, well, I'm not Black or Jew, so why should I come to that tonight? Where you're a human, you know, and there are bigger issues involved. That's just the two groups being highlighted right now. And highlighted very well, by the way. I don't know if you've seen that show. So, I had a weird idea one time to create this sort of one-stop place where it was like imagery from all these different groups, this room, this room, this room, this room. I don't know that I'll ever get to that point. But it certainly has helped me a lot in terms of understanding injustice to study other groups. Even some of the caricatures are the same. I never knew that, you know. The Irish have a mammy, and some of the stereotypes, they're not exactly the same, you know. The Jews have a mammy, have a shrew, you know. The Native Americans have a buck, you know, which is very similar, you know, it's kind of sexualized. It's same as with the squaw, and say the African-American Jezebel, as it were. And so when you start seeing this stuff, I mean, it's not rocket science. You know, what it is that dominant groups use what's available to them to maintain their dominance, and part of what's available to them is the kind of cultural meanings. Now, it's also a case that I've learned that each of those minority groups resisted in many ways, creative ways, you know, with their own art, their own history, their own stories and life. So, I mean, just like I've learned that in the last 10, 15, I mean, I wasn't stupid. I mean, I knew some of it already, but as I've gotten a more nuanced understanding, it's helped me, and I think that it would help other groups. So, I think we almost got to it all. I used to fear that people would come in and, like, take red paint, throw on stuff. Mm-hmm. No one's ever done that. I used to fear that they would, like, scratch up the cases. That was a real legitimate fear I had, that they would scratch up, because we don't have any. Like, you go to most museums, there's pieces out. We will never have anything out. Everything's behind the case. So I thought they would just do that. And the little room, if you remember, doesn't even have a window, because we don't want people just, like, looking in. And I figure out, we have a planning group now to see how much of that's going to remain, as it were. But never had a problem with that. My greatest fear was that people wouldn't get it. And the reality is that in our history, almost everybody got it. Even the ones who didn't like it, they got it. And the few people that didn't get it, unfortunately, were in positions to hurt us. You know, like folks who could have given us a grant, whatever, decided not to vote, that kind of thing. But most people do get it, and they do understand. And for the ones who say that this is just something in the past, again, it was a very fortuitous decision I made to collect modern objects, because they look at those objects and that sort of makes that point not so strong, you know. And this is the final thing, and then I'll shut up. So you got me talking about my favorite topic. I learned, and this is one thing the docents struggle with, and that is, it's like the person who says the bizarre thing, they're showing off, you know, especially students, you know, they're trying to provoke you, that whole piece. And I have to work with the docents on this simple thing. You cannot use your intellectual training advantage to crush that person. Because once you crush a person, you cannot teach them. You just can't. And I don't care, I'm not that Stockholm Syndrome stuff and all the fraternity stuff about tearing someone down and building them up again. I don't buy any of that. What my experience is if I crush you, I may get some temporary cathartic thing, okay? And God help me if I still need that at this age. But I can't teach you. And here's the other part of that. I can't teach the people that watched either. Because it wasn't just you, it was other people in the classroom or the group, whatever it was. And that's something docents struggle with, because people, they bring all that stuff with them in that door. I mean, they bring ideas about black people and Jews and stuff in there with them. And they also bring their insecurities in there. And they bring where they are in their work. They bring all that in there. And if we let people talk, they will talk. And if we create a place that's safe, then they're going to say stuff. And some of it's not going to be very progressive. But you can't crush them. Now, that does not mean you don't challenge them. That does not mean you don't engage them. But you cannot crush them. And that was, again, it's not rocket science, but that was probably the hardest lesson for me as an activist. Because I was running across some of the same, in my mind, backward racist thinking that created these objects. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. I'm trying to create a place where a person is safe to tell me where they are. Now they tell me where they are, and I'm going to make them look like Archibalka in front of all, you know, and so they, I don't know if you read Irving Goffman, but it becomes a kind of a degradation ceremony for them, right? Now how am I going to teach them after that? No, I can't teach them. And I can't teach the other people that watch me do that. And so what it is, and that's a fine kind of thing there, and learning how to engage people where they are, allowing them to save face while still challenging. And so my thing is, a place ought to be safe and uncomfortable. And that's what works for me when I'm doing it. So when they leave there, they don't feel like I made a fool out of them. They don't feel like I made them look like a bigot. They don't feel like they're ashamed and hate, you know, all of that stuff. Now, they may feel those things, but I mean, it's certainly not because I didn't try to not let that happen. So, and we have had very few, really, you know, we had a couple of docents we had to change, because they weren't far enough in their own understanding of race and their identity politics, and they just weren't where they needed to be. And I mean, their hearts were in the right places, but they just weren't. So we had to let them go. And I've become much more involved again in the actual training of people. Because it used to be that, you know, we figure if you had a PhD in sociology or if you had a PhD in history, you had to know certain things. Well, you may have mastered the substantive material, but you may know very little about how to facilitate a difficult discussion. So, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, I'm hopeful for America, if that helps anything. Though it pisses me off all the time.
Me too.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.